Hi everyone, welcome to ADHD Brief. I'm Kaylee Smith, a registered psychotherapist in Ontario and your host. This isn't your typical therapy podcast. Here, I ditch the clipboard and sit down with friends, family, and people with lived experience to have informal, unfiltered conversations about ADHD, mental health, and what it's actually like to live with a neurodivergent brain. As a therapist, I love having these conversations, but this podcast isn't therapy and it isn't intended to provide personal clinical advice. It's real talk, personal stories, and don't worry, we still try to keep it funny. Whether you've been diagnosed, you're exploring your brain, or you're just ADHD curious, welcome. Brains don't always play by the rules. Let's talk about it.
Oh, today we have Gloria on our podcast. So Gloria is someone that I met 4 or 5 years ago. We worked together for about 2 years, I would say.
Yeah.
And Gloria is, I mean, incredible at what she does. She works like providing mental health supports. So she works in, you know, the mental health field. And she has a really fascinating story, just like with her own mental health and what she's gone through. So today's episode is going to be about, we're talking about ADHD and bipolar disorder. So something that isn't talked about, I think, as much publicly, but I think it's an important conversation to have. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Kaylee.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll dive right in. So tell me about your, I guess, journey of first we'll start with ADHD. So what was that like for you? When did you get diagnosed? How did that happen?
So for me, from a really young age, my brother was diagnosed firstly, in a really obvious, like hyperactive way. Mm-hmm. And that was an easy diagnosis to be made. For me, I wasn't as much hyperactive as I was inattentive. Mm. So with being inattentive too, I also had a lot of behavioral problems. Like I was just an angrier kid. Mm. And because I was so young, my diagnosis wasn't until a little bit later because it was confused with my bad attitude. So I think a lot of teachers thought I just had a bad attitude and that I had behavioral problems as opposed to actually asking me what's up. And I would have said, this class is going too slowly and this isn't, you know, like,
yeah.
So I think they just thought I was just a really shitty student. And I finally, it was in about grade 12 in high school. I had gotten into a bit of a shouting match with a teacher and he had said, like, I can't have her in my class, kicked me out. And it was the first time then that the school counselor was like, I think you should get assessed for ADHD.
Wow.
Because it seems like you can't think before you talk, or like you can't think before you act.
That impulse control.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, and then I was diagnosed right thereafter and was allowed back in the class.
Wow. I mean, shout out to that counselor because
it
gets missed in so many people, but in so many girls, especially.
Totally.
Especially if they are more of the inattentive type, or it doesn't present the same way as it does with like younger boys. So good for that counselor. I'm glad she was paying attention.
Yeah. So somebody was finally
before
then it was just like a bad attitude, you know, like they just thought I had a bad attitude, but if you really, you know, scrape the surface and get talking to a kid, you could find out pretty quickly. It's not a bad attitude. It's impatience. It's like lacking executive function, like control and things like that. So yeah, I'm really grateful for that teacher.
Yeah. So do you remember like looking back as a kid that what contributed to not feeling good at school was like I'm bored?
Yeah, it was that I was bored and I didn't want to socialize with anyone.
Oh.
I got bored very quickly and I just didn't really want to make too many friends.
Okay.
So I was just always in a bad mood. But I did have a good group of friends eventually. But just had an attitude, just always had an attitude growing up, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So on the spicier side.
Yeah.
Just a bit angry on edge.
Yeah. Like I wasn't like, I can't focus. You know, it was more just it manifested in like being frustrated easily. Mm-hmm. And like, that's how it expressed itself for me is it's just like, I was always frustrated. Mm. Like, and I could try to articulate myself, but I was still frustrated. Like I felt like I couldn't perform like the rest of my peers, even though I had all the same intentions.
Yeah.
And so it was frustrating for me because I didn't have a name for it or whatever, but.
Do you know what got in the way of you wanting to like make friends? Like, I know I'm really asking you to like go back years and years, but like, do you remember what that was like?
Yeah, because I couldn't really follow like social norms as easily, I think. Oh. So, you know, like making jokes at the wrong time, inappropriately, mm-hmm. just being impatient. Having an opinion about things instead of kind of just going with the flow and you know, if everyone's going to the hockey game, I'll go too. I'm like, why would we go to the hockey game? Like, I questioned everything. And like, I don't think when you're that age, like the priority is to like be part of the clique.
Yeah.
And I so painfully could not be part of the clique mm-hmm. that it just, to me, when I thought friends, I thought, oh, it's just going to be another situation where I don't fit in. Like, I feel unwanted because I don't want to do the same things as them. Like, I just never fit in like that, you know? So
I think that's a really good way to conceptualize it, it felt like this was just one more way that I was going to be like different.
Exactly.
And then it would be more obvious.
Exactly.
That I probably already felt different, but then it's like, you know, something you can't ignore. And I think that's one of the sort of risks that is also less talked about with kids that have ADHD is when they are undiagnosed or untreated, how that can impact social relationships and lead to like, you know, not fitting in, being bullied, not understanding like those social cues or norms or being able to pause or, you know, all of that stuff that gets in the way of social communication and how hard it can be for kids.
Definitely. And it's such a, you're in puberty. It's so important that you fit in at that time.
Yeah.
So when you don't, it's painfully obvious.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you got diagnosed end of high school.
Yeah.
And then what was that like after you finally had that understanding, that diagnosis?
I felt so, so seen. And as soon as I took the medication, I was able to like think before I spoke. I wasn't as frustrated because I didn't have like resentment over things I couldn't keep up with during the day or fit in with during the day. Mm-hmm. Like I just was able to function. Like it just felt like I could melt into everyone else's like social cues, whereas before I couldn't. And so when I went off to university, that was the first time in my life that I excelled at school and made friends simultaneously.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was huge for me. Like university for me was like high school for me. Like it was a redo.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, do you mean in the sense of like when people go, oh, like I peaked in high school, you're like that? No, university no. was like,
yeah, okay. Yeah. I definitely did not peak in high school.
No, okay, that's just because you haven't peaked yet. We all just haven't peaked yet.
It's
coming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so then university was a completely different experience.
Yeah, completely different. Okay. It was like I felt empowered by like, oh my god, if I could have done this whole time, mm-hmm. What would I have been studying in university, you know? So I felt the only thing that would give it kind of like its purpose, like, is to study mental health. Because I was so fascinated by just the juxtaposition between like my high school experience and my university experience was so significant that I thought, what a better way to honor that than figure out how that happened. You know, why? How is the medication effective? How has my life so changed?
Wow.
Those things. Yeah.
So that's what led you into like mental health as like as a direction, as a career.
Yeah it did impact that decision, and it also to just like help me understand myself and help me understand my family members as well. Like
that is why a lot of us get into
the yeah
like, please help me understand my family.
I need to make sense of this or I'm gonna go insane.
For sure Okay. And so did you ever make sense of your family, or are we still working on that?
We're still working on it, but you know what? Like, I'm so glad I know what I'm working with.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, you know, like it, and those connections with my family members are deeper now. Mm. Like, you know, you go through a period of like, oh, that's why they behave like that. Like, you go through a period of like regret or hurt, mm-hmm. but then that transforms into
acceptance
and appreciation.
Yep.
And you go, oh, okay. Like, it just adds a layer of perspective you didn't have towards your family member. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually gotten closer now, like, the more that I learn.
Hmm.
So
interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that can absolutely be the case. The more knowledge you have, the more that you can go, oh, that's what that is. Yeah. That's what's happening. Now I have a label for things. And yeah. even that can be directed inwards too. Mm-hmm. Now that I know this about myself, I can also make sense of my whole world.
Yeah.
And then be able to understand other people better too.
Totally. Totally.
Okay. Where do you think you got ADHD from? Like, which parent?
I think...
like, do you see it in your parents? I shouldn't say which parent, but...
I see it in my... No, that's a good question. I didn't see it in my dad. I saw it in my mom. Mm. More so, like, that woman, like, would walk, like, 6 kilometers a morning, like, just because, like she... Nothing was ever, I don't know. And I wasn't sure if it was that she was just had a very active lifestyle or that she couldn't sit down. I'm not sure which one it was. So my brain goes to, yeah, it's either from her or I think our environment was like a little bit stressful when we were younger. My parents had newly immigrated to Canada. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was kind of some unrest in the mm-hmm. household that kind of manifested in some anxiety and some fidgety and some discomfort. So a part of me thinks it's nurture as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And so that's actually a good sort of thing to touch on as well, is that because your parents had newly immigrated to Canada, like, do you even know how they conceptualized ADHD or mental health in general when you and your brother were kids?
They didn't. They didn't. But that's because, you know, where they're from Eastern Europe, like, they, I don't know, I can't speak for now, but I don't know what it's like now. But when I was younger at that time, like, yeah, mental health was very, like, nothing from the neck up. Mm-hmm. It was like the saying, or I think there's an expression there, but there was, it was labeled as embarrassing and also a sign of weakness, for sure, for sure. So it was like, instead of being like, oh, you're really struggling with X, let me help you, I'll do Y, right? It would be, hey, you're struggling with X, don't let other people see that you're struggling with X. You know what I mean? Like, get yourself together. Like, there was like, God bless them, but a layer of shame that was added to it, as opposed to like a curiosity about it. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you so angry? Mm-hmm. Like, as opposed to like, you're embarrassing me, you know? Like, so some of that just kind of not even an intolerance, but just ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, I think, even just you saying like, why are you so angry? There's so many instances where if people were able to, you know, ask with compassionate curiosity, like, instead of like, why are you so angry?
Exactly.
Why are you so angry?
For real. You'd have to save lives, actually.
You know? Answer. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So that's the family history. So university, thriving, things are much better. What started to shift? Because there's bipolar disorder that has yet to be on the scene.
Yeah. So in university, I had manic tendencies that at the time I kind of laughed off.
Oh.
And was like, maybe I just have a lot of energy. Same like how I said for my mom, maybe she's just really active. Like, I had like a very positive outlook on it. And I was like, I'm just extremely disciplined. it took my roommates and people who lived with me to be like, you know, you haven't eaten in like 2 days, like, how are you running on a treadmill? You know what I mean?
Right.
And I'd be like, what food, what tired? Like, I was a little manic and I couldn't recognize it myself, but people around me were indicating that something was off. And then, periods of extreme lows. Right. And I thought that's kind of how everyone functioned. Like, I don't know. I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I thought I was disciplined and I had a lot of energy.
Yeah.
But then I had a little too much energy. Okay. at the same time, I was going through family emergency. Like, my dad had a major health situation, And the stress of that triggered like I had like a major depressive episode.
Okay.
And that major depressive episode was such a low for me that I actually started getting psychotic symptoms.
Hmm.
So okay. That was the first time I had to be hospitalized. I was psychotic. And it was the first stay, and I really chalked it up to like, I don't know who in my shoes, given the circumstances with what was going on at that time in my life, who wouldn't, you know, have a couple psychotic symptoms, like trying to kind of make it feel like less of a thing. But
yeah.
But then I had to go back to the hospital, and I was like, okay, I don't think it's just a bad day. I think this might be a thing, right? Like this keeps, I'll get stable, then I'll have a major depressive episode. Mm-hmm. And then in the shot back up is when I get psychotic symptoms.
Okay.
So,
because what it sounds like, even when you're describing like those first experiences in university, it sounds like you're sort of going into hypomania.
Yeah.
So like before full blown mania, I've got that excess of energy. Things probably feel really good.
Yep.
Life's a little bit brighter and fuller, and
I'm the funniest person ever. It. Yeah. Just things so confident. Really good,
Like as those dips are happening, then it's going down and then really coming up into full mania. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a bungee cord, right? And all the way back up. Like it was never really like, yeah.
Do you think looking back even before university that you had those fluctuations, like now that you know what you know, or was that really the first time that you started to see that?
No, I'd seen it before.
You had?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I had like major depressive episodes.
Oh, as a kid?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like how young?
Probably like 12.
Wow.
Yeah. 12, 13, 14. Okay. Yeah.
And would you see it as like the...
I would only see the drop. I would never see the up.
Okay. Got it.
The first time I started seeing the up was post that significant thing I was going through with my dad.
Okay.
Like I think the life stress, when it hit like a top, that it just kind of was a chemical explosion.
Right.
But again, I wrote it off as because I'm, you know, navigating my dad. My dad was, God bless him, he's alive now and compromised, but alive. And at the time, there was uncertainty about whether he'd live for like a couple months there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was a significant situation.
Really touch and go.
Yeah. So I chalked it up to that. I was like, nobody would function normally given that, you know. But it's like post that, I still would get the big drop and then the super high.
Right.
And then the super high just kept happening.
Yeah.
And then I went, oh, crap. Like, I don't think this is... this isn't just because of this. It's not an isolated event. It's like, this is a pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair to be a bit unsure about that, because when you look at sort of like what psychosis is, this break from reality, when someone's been under immense stress or has experienced something incredibly traumatic, naturally your brain might go, reality is too painful. Yeah. I can't be in reality. I need to... And that could be psychosis, depersonalization, derealization. Like there's so many different kind of parts of what psychosis can be. Mm-hmm. So I could see why that would be confusing. Is this like my nervous system having a stress response, or is this a pattern?
Something to worry about.
What was that first like experience in the hospital like?
Not very good. Not very good. I don't think any of them were very good because I was in so much denial.
Right.
So much denial. I wasn't there like, oh, I'm in the mental hospital. I was like, who put me in here? What the heck? Like just so in denial that I might have something to do with the reason I was there.
Right.
You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was,
And do you base that off of just like where you were in terms of psychosis that you just couldn't?
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was just like, it's so fucking weird. I keep waking up in the same place. Like, why am I here? Like,
right.
Like I was so deluded. Like I was so psychotic, right? Yeah. That I didn't really, it wasn't until months after that, like I healed enough because psychosis, by the way, is like the equivalent of like a significant brain injury, like when recovering from one, like they release you when you're still psychotic, but at least not a harm to yourself or others. So leaving the hospital still for like 2-3 months.
That's a good way to describe it. I don't think a lot of people realize and make yeah. that connection that it is like as significant yeah. as a major brain injury.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember having to remind myself like what year it was and what, like it actually shook my entire yeah. core, mm-hmm. you know? And just the delusion of like, I don't know why I'm here. Everyone else is crazy. I'm not crazy. Right. Mm-hmm. Like just so deluded. But, you know, over time and with medication, I was stabilized like with the right medication.
Do you remember how long you were there the first time?
I had been there like 2-3 times quickly, like 2-3 days.
Okay.
But then I had one major stay eventually. That was like a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So 2-3 days you're in the hospital trying to figure out why you're there, what's happening. Mm-hmm. And mental health institutions or like hospital settings are not very comfortable ones. So I can imagine being there, especially when you don't want to be, would be quite, I might say traumatizing, but I don't yes. want to use that word. Okay.
Yes.
We can use that word.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
No, I was worried that I couldn't come and go as I pleased out of the unit.
Okay.
I was just like, is this it? Like, am I in jail? Like, it's like, because it's jail, right? When you're in the unit, you can't come, you can't right. leave. So not, I wasn't scared as much as I was just really panicked that like I had done something permanent and mm-hmm. that I might like, because the,
be they, there forever.
Yeah. Because they never tell you what your leaving date is. They tell you the day of and then get you out.
Okay.
And you best really? Believe. Yeah. You best believe 7 days pass, 8 days pass, 9 days pass. And you're like, what? Like where, you know, and the psychiatrist comes in, you know, when am I going home? We don't know. And then wow. out of nowhere, one day they'll say, you're going home today, clean your, you know, so.
See, even something as simple as changing that, you would think would give people a way more peace of mind.
Well, it humanizes even, people too.
Yeah.
You know,
like even if it changes and then, you know, when it gets right. closer to that date, they go, actually, I don't think you're ready to go yet.
Right.
I think it's going to be a few more days, but at least then you know at some point this is going to end.
Yeah. That part, it, like the doom in your stomach, yeah. like it's that part. Yeah.
Were you able to see people like family or friends or?
You could have visitors.
Okay.
So my husband did visit me.
Okay.
My mom a little bit, but she needed to do her own recovering. I think it was hard on her that what I was going through. So,
right.
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So do you, like, what was your, like, memory of being in the hospital? Like, obviously, you've got memories of it. Do you feel like that's something that, like, is still, like, a vivid memory for you? Or does it feel, like, surreal?
I do have a couple memories, like, smells. Like, for me, like, the smell of a hospital. Like, if I go into a hospital, I have to, like, vomit, like, instantly because
wow.
it's so visceral, like, remembering being trapped. Yeah.
Okay. yeah. It's so interesting how our brains can re-experience trauma.
Yeah, for real.
And
yeah.
different senses can be online for whatever reason. And so it doesn't necessarily mean like you're going to re-experience trauma when you go back to the same place, but it could be the same smell or like all kinds of things can yeah. bring it right back.
Even, you know what? I was getting a massage, mm-hmm. like a random Thai massage or something like that. And they make you get into like a gown and lay on the table. And they say, just knock when you're ready. And I had gotten down on the gown and the room was dark and I literally had like a, like I literally started shaking and panicking because I thought I was back in the hospital wow. in my gown.
Okay.
Like, so yeah, it like staying at the hospital when you're not well mentally is like a trauma in itself, to yeah. be honest. And there's no care, you know, that's a consideration for another day, but okay. I think there really should be some aftercare that addresses, mm-hmm. you know,
what you went through and what that yeah. was like.
Yeah.
And I do agree with what you're saying, like humanizing it
yeah.
can, I think, make a huge difference for people. Like I had my assistant on a podcast episode and she talked about being in Homewood for a stay and how at the end of the stay, they stamped sane on their hands when they were ready to go home. Yeah. And she still That's has the picture. Nice. She showed me the picture. And it's like little things like that. I'm like,
that makes the eyebrow flick.
Seems archaic. And that for her was, I think, like 10 years ago. So we're not talking that long ago.
Like, let me stamp your hand. Yeah. You know, don't worry about my hand.
Yeah.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, listen, if you're stamping sane on people's hands, it's because you probably haven't been to the hospital yourself. Because you wouldn't be doing that. Like, you'd know how stressful that was.
Yeah.
To not make like light of it with a stamper that says sane. But.
And so through the different like hospitalizations, I'm assuming medication was a part of treatment.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Voluntary medication?
Not initially. Not initially. Okay. I was formed, right? So then it was recognizing that I did need it in order to continue to function.
Okay.
Because if I was ever not taking it, I would start to spiral again. Like, and it was like an indication that like, okay, I have bipolar disorder. It's not just because I was going through something, and it's not just because I didn't eat enough. It's not just because the weather's a little off. Like there's a problem here. Mm-hmm. And I need to consistently take medicine to manage it. Okay. So.
Did you try to go off meds like when you would get out of the hospital?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Okay. You would stay on your medication?
Yeah. Anything not to go back to the hospital. Yeah.
That's what kept you taking
them. If there wasn't a risk of going back to the hospital, like, yeah, I'd conduct myself differently.
Okay. Because that is like, I worked for quite a while with, I worked for like homes for special care. So it was for people who had like mainly med resistant schizophrenia.
Ooh.
There was some bipolar disorder, some other forms of psychotic disorders, but, medication adherence was one of the hardest things. Like, in order for them to live where I worked, they had to take medication.
True.
But we would have to check their mouths, like make sure that we were looking on the floors after meds had been, you know, given out, because a lot of times they don't want to because of all of the side effects.
Right.
Like how hard that is on people's bodies and brains, and it makes you tired, and it makes you, you know, it can make you gain weight. It can make you feel like not yourself. So that part is so hard, but it's the, you know, when you stop taking medication that then the psychosis can start again. So it's such a delicate balance of having to take it even if you don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just it's kind of like cuffs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'd rather feel a little, you know, a little bit of a limitation than, you know, have no limits and have paranoid thoughts and like have psychotic symptoms. Like, you know, it's okay. I think it's a compromise. You just have to, make it. It sucks. Like, accepting that you have to be on a medication that so significantly changes like how you feel, it's hard on your gut health. Like it is a commitment, but it's worth it once you understand what it's protecting you from. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in university, you're taking ADHD medication, I'm assuming stimulant medication.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does that medication interact with bipolar disorder? Like, is that medication you're still able to take?
So the thing is, when I was taking Vyvanse for my ADHD for the 4 years of university, and by the end there is when, you know, I had that significant life stress and was hospitalized from psychotic symptoms, and then they took me off of all my medications because they suspected that maybe the Vyvanse was playing a role in it.
Okay.
They were kind of controlling for different things, right?
Yeah.
So they take it out because they think it's the Vyvanse. I still go crazy. They're like, oops, okay, no. Like, it's a little bit of trial and error till they find out.
I love that you can laugh about this. Because this does bring a bit of lightness to this, like, very dark conversation. Yeah.
All you can do is laugh. But yeah, they were like, oh, it's the Vyvanse. And then I still had psychotic symptoms. And they're like, okay, it's not the Vyvanse. But it might have been. So we're not taking the risk of adding that back to your lineup. And so I've been untreated. Oh, sorry. There's a tree behind me.
There's a tree behind you.
Oh my goodness. I've been untreated for my ADHD for when I started my bipolar medication.
Okay.
And I have for the first time, like just recently, I started a non-stimulant ADHD right. medication.
And that was very recent. Very that was recent, like, yeah. what, two, three weeks ago? Yeah.
Yeah. It's good, but the side effects mm-hmm. are not really the vibe. Like,
yeah.
like you get up and like see six things. Like, it's like, ugh, like so dizzy.
Yeah, I did. Okay, so for anyone that's listening, she started Intuniv, the brand name or generic, whatever the actual name is, yeah. is guanfacine. So it can lower your blood pressure. And so it is an alpha, I believe it's an alpha 2 agonist. So it's not like a stimulant medication. It's more of a, to bring down hyperactive symptoms, but it can also really lower your blood pressure. So it sounds mm-hmm. like that's when you're saying I get up in the morning yeah, and I see six things. We're not talking about psychosis.
Yeah, sorry, not psychosis. We're talking about low blood pressure. At this time, just low blood pressure. Okay.
I just want to make sure everyone's following along. Everyone is safe here. yeah, it's so okay. So then you can't take stimulant medication.
I can't. My psychiatrist might trial me on it. Okay. You know, I don't think she's going to.
How do you feel about that?
I don't think I ask myself, right? Like, are the ADHD symptoms more annoying than the risk that it would potentially pose if I tried right. medication? And it's not worth it.
It's not worth it for you.
Yeah. I think I'd rather, like, I just am so traumatized by having psychotic mm-hmm. symptoms that I just never want to feel them again. Hopefully yeah. that's a reality for me.
Yeah.
So far, so good. Knock on wood. I haven't yeah. had any episodes or anything. So I'm on the right meds. Why break something that's
yeah.
not, whatever that saying is.
Yeah. If it's not broken.
If it's not broken. Yeah.
Yeah. It is an interesting perspective. Like I go to ADHD conferences, and this is a conversation that's been talked about, I think actually at probably the last two conferences I've been to, where they talk about what, when you're treating ADHD with medication, what other like concurrent disorders you need to treat first. And so bipolar disorder is one of them. You have to stabilize that before you can treat the ADHD just right. because of, you know, risk of psychosis and, yeah. you know, mania and, or all of the risks that can come with a, you know, a depressive episode. But there is, like, I guess, new research about the fact that once you've stabilized bipolar disorder, you can bring, you know, stimulant medication back on board, but it is so person to person dependent. Like mm-hmm. some people mm-hmm. cannot tolerate it, or like you, if you go, I don't even want to take that risk, it's not worth it for me because I know what can happen and yeah. I just don't feel comfortable. So yeah. that's a tough spot to be in.
Yeah, it kind of sucks, right? It's like, it takes the option out of the matter.
Yeah.
So, but I'll do anything never to have to see that building again.
The inside of the hospital. Yeah, yeah, fair
yeah.
enough.
Yeah.
How do you work with your ADHD now if you don't take medication?
Honestly, prioritizing staying organized over like what I'm actually trying to accomplish mm-hmm. at work. So like I just have to be sickly organized.
Okay. It's you are very way. Organized. Yeah, if someone we used to work together. With you, yeah. It's like, cause my brand of ADHD is not the organized kind. Like I'm a disaster. It's like, it's just chaos all the time. Yeah. But you are always so structured and like, yeah. Your mind is like, I've always said your mind is like a computer. Like I do not understand how your brain works because it's like,
neither do
just,
I.
It's just, yeah, you are very organized and very structured.
Thank you.
So yeah. that's like one of your sort of, I guess, compensatory strategies.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, okay. it's like hyper-focusing on making essentially how organized can I make this so that I don't actually have to think critically.
Oh.
Like I actually just like okay. fill things out. I make like a template of what it is I need to absorb for the day
yeah.
and just let it flow in and then deal with it later. So just a lot of compensatory organizational strategies okay. that do the organizing for me so I can process it at a later time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you notice it like ADHD showing up anywhere outside of work? Like where it is hard to manage symptoms sometimes?
Yeah. Like, I haven't watched a movie in probably like 6 years.
I don't watch movies either.
Yeah, movies are just
They're so long.
Right?
So long. I can do a 40-minute show episode, but
that's stretch.
Me watching a movie with my husband is, I mean, he'll watch the entire movie, and I've gotten up 8 times, and I don't know what I'm doing.
On TikTok, you know? Yeah. Outside of work, so for me it's like staying seated is very hard for me.
Mm-hmm,
like very hard. Like, you know, I look at my husband, I'm like, man, my life would be so much easier if I just, it never occurred to me that I need to get up and do something.
Like
yeah, having that freedom, that peace of mind that nobody's on your back, you know.
Yeah,
like for me, I'm like, there's something I should be doing, you know. I jump up and I fix it. There's something I need to fix, you know, as opposed to just being like, everything's fine the way it is, and like being present. Like, so I think a little hyperactivity, or however you want to call it.
I think it's the fidgeting too. Like, yes, I have to, you know, do a bit of a disclosure with my clients. Like, just, you know, I'm not interested in what you're saying just because I'm fidgeting. It's because I have such a hard time staying still.
Yeah.
So it's either like I definitely have to move my hands and do something, or you just see me like, you know, constantly shifting and moving. And because it's an hour is a long time.
That's a long time. That's a long time.
Okay. So you're up and down and up and down. Got it.
Do you ever ask your patients like, Hey, just stop talking for a second.
No. No.
Let me just process that and then we'll keep going.
No, because my hyper focus is people talking. Like,
true.
As much as I like move around, I'm so interested in other people's stories and feelings. And like, I'm very, I think, engaged when it comes to being in a room with someone. I can sit for an hour, but the movie, game over.
Yeah.
Not gonna happen.
Right? Never.
So that's where you notice it. How do you try to manage it?
Exercise is huge for me. Like, honestly, like nine out of 10 fights are avoided with my partner if I exercise.
Okay.
Like, if I don't exercise, I'm like, I have energy that's unspent. Mm-hmm. I need to do something. But if I exercise, I come home so tired that I'm too lazy to argue about anything. I'm too lazy to fixate over what it is I'm eating tomorrow. I'll figure it out then. Like, it just, it takes like a layer of anxiety off of me, like strips it right off. So that's been like actually life changing, like a sustainable change I've made that really helps me manage my mood.
That's a big one for you.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that conflict seeking in relationships can actually be dopamine seeking. So consciously you're going, I don't want to have a fight, I don't want to argue, subconsciously your brain's like, give me a hit. Yeah. I need some dopamine. I need
beef right now.
Something to like get my nervous system going. Totally. So if you're regulating your nervous system with exercise and I'm getting that dopamine, that reward, you're not looking for it later with a conflict.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. I tire myself out so that I'm the nicest version of myself.
Yeah.
By 8 p.m., you know, when I'm in bed. It's like, hello, as opposed to like, you know, get out of my spot, you know. So you got to exercise.
So it sounds like maybe it's also helped with anger or irritability.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I feel for me, and I don't know, for me, anger is always the way that my mind like manifests like the expression of what's actually like. Anger underneath, what do they say? A lot of anger is sadness, actually.
Mm. Well, yeah, anger is the tip of the iceberg. It's usually something else underneath it. And for a lot of people, it can be sadness.
Yeah. Yeah. Like for me, it's always just my brain's immediate. Like most people, their immediate is like, you know, like sadness or maybe even crying to release some of that stress or whatever. For me, it's just like anger.
Oh, mine too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And me always.
You as well? Yeah. Always, yeah. It's just beef.
I'm always teetering right on the edge of snapping. Okay. Not actually, but I could.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's definitely anger is the go to, which
you
I
too,
think
eh?
Because it's an emotion that moves. Like it has some movement to it and it takes the heat off of me and puts it onto something else.
Totally.
Whereas like sinking into sadness
can feel a little too close.
Yeah, very personal, but that's a whole other episode about therapy itself. Anyways.
Yeah. That's neat, though. I didn't know that you also manifest as anger. That's interesting. Yeah. Now that I think about it, though, that makes sense.
Yeah, we used to work together. I'm surprised that you're shocked by that. Okay, so exercise has been a big one for you. Was that hard for you to get into? Like, realizing how helpful that was? Like, getting into that as a routine? Because that's something I hear about with a lot of my clients, is that sticking to that routine is so hard.
Yeah.
Keeping up with it, time management around it, finding something that you enjoy doing. If it doesn't provide immediate dopamine, like sticking with it, like there's a lot of barriers to having an exercise routine.
What helps me is like, I kind of reframe it and I go, if I exercise today, then that's all I need to accomplish. And everything else is just like, oh, sweet.
I love that.
Yeah. As opposed to like, oh, I went to work today and now I'm tired. It's like, no, my priority is going to the gym. And if I happen to work that day, that's unfortunate. You know what I mean? Like flipping like the reward system in my head helps a lot.
That's actually a good way to put it, because I think that I'm also someone that exercises. I mean, I would say 7 days a week, but like one day is like just, you know, a basic walk.
Yeah.
But like I'm moving my body every day, no matter what, because that to me has been the one thing that has kept me like stable and sane, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, one of the ways that I've sort of reframed it as like, this is the priority.
Yeah.
And it's like I hyper focus on it. When can I do it?
Yeah.
Is it a Peloton in the morning before work, or do I have time to like, if I have a midday, can I sneak to the gym midday? Or like, and I think about it, doing it after work. And it's like, I had to make it my like whole focus.
Totally. Totally. I think that's the only way for it to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. Like, cause I think once you go, oh, I've got this like 3 month plan and I'm gonna be so skinny. It's like, maybe that'll work. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll work. But then how do you repeat that? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not sustainable. But like when you make it like a sustainable change, like that's where it's at. Like, and by prioritizing exercise over anything else, that's a sustainable change. Cause like right currently, if you're not working out, you're prioritizing TikTok and Instagram. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of choosing your priorities. Mm-hmm. Like,
and I like also that you said, it's not about what necessarily like what it's doing for your physical body. Like, I think exercise above anything else, do it for your mental health and the physical
will follow.
Like, whether that is weight loss or, you know, building strength or, you know, having less pain or, you know, more flexibility, whatever that is, that's like a secondary gain, but do it for your mental health first. And it, in my opinion, can become way more sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than have to do it
because I feel six crunches like because
there's something wrong with my body and seeing it as a negative.
Totally. Yeah. I think there's an important shift that needs to happen with exercise. I was saying this to my husband the other day, is it when exercise feels like a punishment.
Yep.
Like, I'm punishing my body because I ate a bag of Doritos like yesterday. Ew, I can't stand this part of my body. Like, you can, that only goes so far. Like, it works. And then you realize, oh, that part of my body is not really changing.
Yeah.
Like, so then you realize like, okay, exercise is actually just about getting my engine moving. It's, and if my engine happens to look nice, that's fantastic. Like, so yeah.
So above all, do it for your mental health, people, and start small. You don't have to, you know, just start with like a walk or, you know, just moving your body in some way.
Yeah.
And I think the rewards really do follow.
Oh, yeah. Eat less, move more.
Okay. Not for everybody.
I always...
We won't get into too much of that because there could be people listening with disordered eating.
Sorry. Well, there also could be people trying to gain weight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So
then eat more, move less. But... Never mind.
Anyways, moving on.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of the things that you do for your ADHD. Mm-hmm. What would you say to someone that's listening that has just been diagnosed with bipolar disorder or wonders about this? Or like, can you speak to maybe someone that is feeling shame or the stigma around it? Like, what would you say to that person?
I would say that it is an extremely large thing to accept, and just give space for yourself to acknowledge how much of a how large of a realization that is. Don't rush the realization, because then you're going to keep denying it and stretching it out farther, having another psychotic episode, and then like you're just take the time it requires for you to receive the information, process it, and understand you need to implement some things to put some protective factors in place from being symptomatic in the future. So don't rush it, take time, and it hurts. Like, it really hurts to find out that, like, that's a lifelong commitment, but there's a lot of solutions nowadays. There's medication that can support you. And frankly, people who are bipolar, like, often are extremely intelligent in a certain area, or they're extremely skilled at a particular instrument. Like, for whatever reason, people with bipolar always have something kind of a little bit unique about them. And I think there's something, you can't have something unique without any pain, you know? So, sometimes God chooses people for a reason, you know, so sometimes he thinks you can handle it. That as well, I think when you're going through it, it's like, I can't handle this. I can't commit to this. Like, I can't have bipolar disorder for the rest of my life. It's like, what if God thinks you can actually handle that?
Okay, like, so because you're such like, a G. It sounds, you know? Like faith for you is also something that's helped with that acceptance.
Yeah. Like, maybe I'm loved because I got this diagnosis, like challenging your instinct to go, maybe I'm disappointing or I failed in some ways, and that's why I got this diagnosis. Like, actually flipping it on its head and being like, maybe there's something, there is actually some benefit to me having this diagnosis. Maybe, you know, like challenge it, challenge the idea. Never accept anything at face value, because just because somebody told you something, that's a stupid reason to believe something. You have to do your own research. You have to, you know, compartmentalize it how you choose, and negotiate with it and eventually land somewhere to where you're not, you know, beating yourself up, and you love who you are regardless of what you look like and what you feel like.
That was beautiful.
Thanks.
The only part I don't agree with is don't believe something that someone's told you, because that just undoes all of my TikTok efforts of where I get 99% of my information. If it's, someone said it on TikTok, it's 100% true. I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. No, that was really good. That was a really beautiful, I think, reframe of all of that, because it can, I can only imagine how hard that would be to accept, and how much grief you might have to process in getting to that acceptance of, what does this mean for the rest of my life? How am I going to be able to manage this? What does this mean about me?
Yeah.
Like, even sharing it with people in your life like that, that's a lot of stuff to have to think about.
Even like having kids and having bipolar disorder, there's additional risks, right, with postpartum psychosis that you might be more likely to have. And like, yeah, it affects a lot of different areas. It does. It does. I guess, you know, if it helps me think like, okay, well, what if I was a diabetic? I'd be affected in 7 different areas of my life as well, right? So
yeah,
it's kind of, you know, it's health. It's mental, but it's health.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've done a good job coming to a place of acceptance and understanding yourself. It sounds like you're also very in tuned with your body, like understanding your symptoms and noticing those shifts and to help manage it.
Yeah. It took a lot of kicking and screaming, but I'm finally, finally here.
Good for you. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Okay, any final thoughts? Anything that I haven't touched on?
Maybe a car. And you might need to cut this part out. But is there, I can't say a client on your caseload, but is there a concept you've learned in school while becoming a therapist yourself, that like, what is right now the clinical understanding of bipolar? Like, are they mindful of it being, like, as like, I guess everything we've just talked about, like, is bipolar still just somebody who's manic and somebody who's low? Like, how
is it like conceptualized or understood?
Like, I'm curious to hear.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, this is just obviously coming from my sort of understanding of it and the DSM, like our diagnostic statistical manual, there's, you know, bipolar one. So that is like clear cut, like major depressive episodes with like full manic episodes. There's also bipolar two. So that would be, you know, less severe, you know, up and down. That could be just hypomania. Like, it could last a shorter amount of time. There's also like cyclothymia. I'm mm-hmm. sure I'm probably missing one or two. So it is, I think, more understood that it isn't always necessarily this clear cut high and low, and mm-hmm. there can be different fluctuations. And I would say too, from the ADHD lens of my work, I have heard from clients more than once that they have been misdiagnosed with bipolar 2 mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because there isn't a clear manic episode or, you know, major depressive episode, where turns out it was actually ADHD. And they were losing sleep or not eating or hyper-focusing only for a brief period of time because they were so, so interested in something. And then they go into, you know, actually just burnout or mm-hmm. depression that follows, feeling overwhelmed, feeling like they've taken on too much, like, and it isn't actually bipolar, but they're able to treat the ADHD and those fluctuations go away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it can be so different for so many people, and it can just look so different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, I know it did.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on and talking about it, because I do think that there is a lot of stigma around bipolar disorder and what it means and what it can look like, and mm-hmm. you know, people's belief about being able to live with it and functionality and all kinds of things. Right. So I think you really kind of put a face or a voice to maybe helping people understand it more. So I think that is really appreciated,
yeah,
at least
you.
For me.
Thank
and
you.
Hopefully from people listening.
Yeah. And thank you for giving me the space to talk about bipolar without shame.
Yeah.
You'll go through a period of extreme shame when you, you know, receive the diagnosis, but there's nothing more rewarding than getting to the other side where there's not shame anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's just who you are, and you love yourself still.
Yay. Yeah. No shame here ever.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Good. All right. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in to ADHD Brief. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing or sharing it with someone who might relate. For more information on resources from today's episode, check out the show notes on your listening platform or feel free to contact us directly. The views and opinions shared by my guests are their own and may not always reflect mine. At ADHD Brief, we value open conversations and differing perspectives. I encourage listeners to approach each episode with kindness and curiosity. Even when something comes from a place of stigma or misunderstanding, offering grace and compassion creates more room for growth than criticism ever could. Thanks for tuning in.